The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Today I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine, dated October 24/October 31, 2022. As usual, the border is in red on the front cover. There's no inner white border today because the background of the entire page is white. And Time, in its usual large capitalized block lettering, is light gray superimposed upon that white. Also, an illustration of the late President Abraham Lincoln is superimposed upon that white background. It's a very classic photo of him dressed in black in the trousers, vest, and long tunic coat, black bow tie, and white shirt of the time. He holds a tall top hat at his side, and his left hand is clutching the lapel on the left side of his jacket. Bearded, with a full head of dark hair, he is peering into a fissure which is in gradations of gray that appears across this white background. So it looks like he's looking down into a fissure in a crack of ice or a glacier. The heading reads, "How Our Greatest President Saved Democracy, and We Can Too." Moving now to For the Record. Eight short items. A dark day for all involved in football, and a tragedy beyond comprehension. Giannini Infantino, president of FIFA, said after a stampede at a soccer match in Indonesia, October 1, led to more than 120 deaths. 2 million barrels per day reduction in oil production agreed to October 5 by OPEC Plus, a group led by Russia and Saudi Arabia, sparking price hikes. No one should be in jail just for using or possessing marijuana, President Biden said in an October 6 tweet, announcing pardons for anyone convicted under federal law of possessing the drug. "I did not see this coming at all," said Sarah Koenig, host of the podcast Serial, to the New York Times on prosecutors' decision to free Adnan Syed after his conviction for the 1999 murder of Hay Min Lee was overturned following Koenig's investigation. "If we are to navigate our way through this period of historic fragility, we must weave a new economic and social fabric," said Kristalina Georgieva, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, October 6. The IMF later lowered its global growth forecast for 2023. 66. Number of clinics that have stopped providing abortions since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, according to an analysis released October 6 by the Guttmacher Institute. "If black people don't speak up for each other, who will?" said Clayton English, comedian, on a lawsuit he and fellow entertainer Eric Andre filed October 11, alleging that black flyers are racially profiled by police at the Atlanta airport. 2,560, the weight in pounds, recorded October 10, of Minnesota horticulture teacher Travis Ginger's pumpkin, a North American record. That is over a ton of pumpkin. Under the heading History, Lincoln's Lesson, How Our Greatest President Saved Democracy. Meacham, the author, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and the Rogers Chair in the American Presidency at Vanderbilt University, and is author of the new book, And There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle, from which this essay is adapted. John Meacham writes at noon, Monday, March 4, 1861, a day observers noted had dawned cloudy and raw, but turned bright and warm. Abraham Lincoln emerged from the 14th Street northwest door of Willard's Hotel, accompanied by President James Buchanan. The two men rode together in an open carriage up Pennsylvania Avenue, bound for the covered platform that had been erected on the east front for the presidential inauguration. Double files of cavalrymen escorted the procession to the Capitol. Cross streets had been closed to secure the route in the event of attack. Sharpshooters were stationed on rooftops along the avenue with orders, an officer recalled, to watch the windows on the opposite side and to fire upon them in case any attempt should be made to fire from those windows on the presidential carriage. An hour later, hatless and adjusting his eyeglasses, Abraham Lincoln, his inaugural address in hand, stood and gazed out across a large audience. Federal artillery was deployed on a nearby hilltop. Plainly, the central idea of secession is the essence of anarchy, the new president said. Why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in the world? In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I shall have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. Hated and hailed, excoriated and revered, Abraham Lincoln served as President of the United States in an existential hour. Other presidents have been confronted with momentous decisions of war and peace, of life and death, of freedom and power. Yet it fell to Lincoln to adjudicate whether the nation would, in his phrase, remain half slave and half free, and whether the American experiment would survive the treason of a rebellious white South that put its own interests ahead of the Union itself. A president who led a divided country in which an implacable minority gave no quarter in a clash over power, race, identity, money, and faith has much to teach us in our own 21st century moment of profound polarization, passionate disagreement, and differing understandings of reality. Newspaper headlines warn of an impending civil war. And in a recent YouGov Economist poll, 54% of self-identified strong Republicans thought a civil war was at least somewhat likely in the next decade. Such fears can seem hyperbolic in the prospect of great armies forming and clashing in the continental U.S. is blessedly remote. Yet, honesty compels us to confront this fact. While civil war in the third decade of the 21st century is unlikely, civil chaos with episodic violence is already with us. We do ourselves no favors by pretending that somehow everything will just work out. History can inform our struggle over the survival of democratic institutions, and, as important, should help us see the imperative of pursuing justice. For while Lincoln cannot be wrenched from the context of his particular times, his story does illuminate the ways and means of politics, the marshaling of power in a democracy, the persistence of racism, and the capacity of conscience to help shape events. He governed a nation in which a violent and vociferous element was captive to its own visions and controlled by its own interests. Domestic slavery is the greatest distinguishing character of the Southern states, and is, in fact, the only important institution which they can claim as peculiarly their own. Abel P. Upser, a Virginian who served as Secretary of State under John Tyler, wrote in 1839, "White Southerners dreamed of a slave empire headquartered in the American South, but stretching to Cuba, to Mexico, to Central and South America. Such a white-dominated new nation," a Charleston, South Carolina newspaper wrote, "would ensure slaveholders a great destiny." Lincoln kept the American experiment in self-government alive when it seemed lost. He did not do so alone. Ordinary people, black and white, sacrificed to preserve the Union against the designs of the rebel South. But Lincoln was instrumental, and his ultimate vision of the nation, that the country should be free of slavery, was informed by a moral understanding of life. To him, America ought to seek to practice the principles of the Declaration of Independence as fully as possible, for the alternatives were so much worse. What if the constitutional order failed and the Union permanently divided? A durable, oligarchical, white Southern slave empire, surely strengthened and possibly expanded, would have emerged from the war. And as Lincoln saw, the viability of self-government would be in ruins. Lincoln did not bring about heaven on earth, nor does he stand as a paragon of equality and justice for all. Yet he defended the possibilities of democracy at an hour in which the means of amendment, adjustment, and reform were under prolonged and almost successful assault. Lincoln's motives were moral as well as political. A reminder, our finest presidents are those who are committed not only to the pursuit of power, but also to bringing a flawed nation closer to justice. Such requires an understanding that politics divorced from conscience is fatal to the American experiment in liberty under law. This lesson is essential for us in today's unfolding democratic crisis. The forces of unchecked power are self-evidently in the ascendant, and they're the controlling element of one of our two major parties. The past is not always prologue, but history suggests our divisions are as deep as they have been since Lincoln's time, and thus his experience repays consideration. When an element within the nation seeks its own power and its own way, over and above any other factor, that element must be confronted, or else everything might be lost. In exploring Lincoln's example, we can see how arduous American democracy is, and we can glimpse what must be done to preserve it. An American president must be committed to something larger than his own hold on power. And the American people must be willing to accept the give and take of the constitutional order, even when, especially when, events and moral claims call on us to give rather than to take. Lincoln's often depicted as either a secular saint, the savior of union, and the great emancipator, or as a calculating political creature imprisoned by public opinion and white prejudice. The truth is more complicated. Driven by the convictions that the Union was sacred and that slavery was wrong. Lincoln was instrumental in saving one and destroying the other. A man of power, he ultimately demanded the nation follow a moral path through the brute physicality of civil war. His ancient faith, Lincoln once said, teaches me that all men are created equal and that there can be no moral right in connection with one man's making a slave of another. In common usage, to say something is moral is to say that it's about the degree to which one's conduct is in harmony with the commandment that one ought to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. From Plato to Kant, the substance of what is known as the Golden Rule, one common to the world's religious and moral traditions, has occupied philosophers across the ages. Lincoln's own sensibility, both moral and political, was founded on this injunction. As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master, he once said. This expresses my idea of democracy. For Lincoln, a world in which power was all, in which the assertion of a singular will trumped all, in which force dictated all, was not moral, but immoral, not democratic, but autocratic, not just, but unjust. In the White House, Lincoln defended black Americans as fellow human beings, whose fundamental rights were protected in the Declaration of Independence, hardly the most common of arguments in his time. Yet he sometimes spoke in racist terms, did not immediately press for black people to be afforded the rights of citizenship enjoyed by white people, and proposed their voluntary removal offshore. And Lincoln portrayed his decision on wartime emancipation as a last resort, based on military rather than moral considerations. This was the pragmatic Lincoln that Frederick Douglass understood. Viewed from the genuine abolition ground, he said in 1876, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, determined. As Reconstruction gave way to Jim Crow segregation, Douglass's opinion was less widely shared. Abraham Lincoln was a Southern poor white, poorly educated, unusually ugly, awkward, ill-dressed, cruel, merciful, peace-loving, a fighter, despising Negroes and letting them fight and vote, protecting slavery and freeing slaves, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1922. He was a man, a big, inconsistent, brave man. It is true, Lincoln did not seek immediate abolition. Neither was he a radical, racial egalitarian. He was rather a gradual emancipationist who wanted to compensate slave owners. The anti-slavery Lincoln was born in and came to lead a nation in which anti-black prejudice was a fact of life. There was hardly a mighty current of sentiment abroad in the land to emancipate the enslaved and extend citizenship to the newly freed in a promised land of racial and civil equality. Yet to depict Lincoln as only a reluctant warrior against slavery fails to do him justice. He did not waver from a morally informed insistence that slavery be put on a path to ultimate extinction. He maintained this position to his political detriment. Throughout the 1850s, he won no major office between a single term in the U.S. House and his election to the presidency in 1860. Vitally, he refused to retreat from his anti-slavery commitment during the crisis over secession in 1860 to 61, a time when a purely political man might have done, and he stood by emancipation after 1862. Declining to give in to pressure for a negotiated peace with the Confederacy in order to end a devastating war. He campaigned on an abolitionist constitutional amendment in 1864. There are photos here, one of which is, well, they're all in black and white, one of which is a group of freedmen gathering at a wharf during the Civil War. What is traditionally called the last photograph of Lincoln from life, February 5, 1865. This is a headshot of him just staring almost sullenly into the camera. And finally, a photo, interestingly, of the Capitol building, March 4, 1861, when Lincoln was inaugurated, and it's not finished. The dome is not in place. Anathema to much of the white South and to its allies in the North, Lincoln frustrated abolitionists who were more advanced than he on freedom and egalitarianism. He was attacked for defending a constitution that protected slavery and for fighting to preserve politics in which racial prejudice was a dominant factor. The implication of such criticism was that Lincoln made a fetish of the Union at the expense of pursuing true justice. The problem with such a view, however, is that without union, there could be no freedom for the enslaved. Had Lincoln simply bade the South well and set about creating a separate free nation, he would have consigned millions of enslaved black people and their progeny to unrelenting and unrepentant masters. Douglas wrote, he would prefer the Union even with slavery than to allow the slaveholders to go off and set up a government. A successful Confederate States of America might well have expanded its reach southward. Thus, after January 1, 1863, Lincoln's war for Union was simultaneously a war for Union and for emancipation in the seceded states. After congressional passage of the 13th Amendment in early 1865, it became a war for Union and for emancipation for all. An illustration here, or perhaps it's a photoshopped photograph. It looks photoshopped to me. In the background is the Capitol building in Washington, District of Columbia, with its dome on top, with the U.S. flag flying on the top balcony, or actually it's an open area, with blue, gray, whitey, cloudy skies in the background, in the foreground, the U.S. flag, but it's not the entire flag. It looks like a ring of stars, and I'm unable to count them because of the furls in the flag. And it's in the midst of a clump of people dressed in winter attire, jackets with hoods, caps, hats, masks on their faces, scarves, lots of flags flying, with some indicia on some of the caps stating Trump in large lettering. It was the January 6th riot at the Capitol, where supporters of President Trump tried to overturn the 2020 election. Returning to the text, Lincoln understood the magnitude of the issue, and he knew that upon its resolution rested the fate of American democracy, if American democracy was to be the project by which the nation sought to live up to the promise of the Declaration. Slavery is not a matter of little importance, Lincoln said in 1858. It overshadows every other question in which we are interested. As he confronted the question, he juggled political reality and his own moral convictions, convictions he hoped the nation would come to share. The work of a democracy is to lead a sufficient number of individuals to share a moral vision about power, liberty, justice, security, and opportunity, in the hope that people and peoples might be in closer harmony with the good. As a multitude of individuals, a nation possesses a collective conscience, one that is manifest in how that nation chooses, through the means of politics, to view rights and responsibilities. In the 1860s, war was required to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice. That is the great fact of the American story. Secessionist white Southerners chose to fight and die rather than surrender an aristocracy of race. The Civil War, Lincoln told Congress in 1861, presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or democracy, a government of the people by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes. The battle of the third decade of the 21st century is, for now, of a different scale, but we've already seen attempted insurrection, and many adherents of one of our two major political parties refuse to accept the legitimacy of the 2020 election, setting the stage for subsequent denials of reality as soon as next month's midterms. While the Civil War era, therefore, is not a precise analogy, we would be derelict in our duties as citizens if we did not reckon with what Lincoln reckoned with, the often self-sacrificing demands of decency and of democracy. On that March Monday in 1861, Lincoln spoke to the ages. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when, again touched, as surely they will be by the better angels of our nature. The words are immortal, as are angels, but Lincoln teaches us even now that those angels will not take up the cause unless we do too. One more photo, small, sepia-colored, a big wall upon which many, maybe three dozen, people are standing with rifles or bayonets or something upward on the ground or over their shoulders, gallows in front, spectators in front, the conspirators in Lincoln's assassination executed July 7, 1865. To measure a movement, and this is going to be abridged. 5 years after Me Too went viral, its founder reflects on why we are still falling short, by Tarana Burke. As the outrage over Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination grew, I received an unexpected invitation. Senator Dianne Feinstein asked me to be at the Capitol in person to hear the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford, who'd come forward with a claim she'd been sexually assaulted by Kavanaugh 30 years prior, when they were in high school. I had founded the Me Too movement to support survivors of sexual assault in 2006, so I spent the year since the Me Too hashtag went viral late in 2017 on a lightning-fast run of red carpet events, magazine covers, and television appearances. They were so far from what was normal in my life, I often felt completely out of sorts. But here was our first major organizing opportunity, responding to the call of groups fighting against gender-based injustice. Survivors and allies sang out in protest against the appointment of the ultra-conservative Trump nominee, who faced allegations of sexual violence. It was the first time I'd seen our cause send people into the streets en masse. The hearing room was smaller than it looked on television. I remember being unsure where to sit. This was not like a wedding, where seats were assigned by sides. As the session began, the room slowly reorganized itself across partisan lines. Niceties were exchanged as folks swapped seats and scooted down to be allied accordingly. Yet in the end, beyond the political allegiances at the center of that day, only a handful of us were actually there to support Ford. But hearing her recall the fear she felt during her assault, thinking she might die, how her attacker's sinister laughter was indelible in the hippocampus was more than I could stand. I could not see Ford's face as she told her story, which Kavanaugh denied, but I could see her attorney squeeze her arm or rub her back occasionally. Each small gesture and every change in her voice cracked me open a little bit wider. When they called for a break, I found a bathroom on another floor and holed myself up in a stall so I could cry in peace. It was not long before I heard people come in, so I muffled my cries in my sleeve and pulled myself together. As I stood in front of the sink washing my hands, a woman came up beside me to do the same. I was fairly used to women having a reaction to seeing me in public at this point, and she did. "Oh, my goodness," she cried. "It's you." I gave her the warmest smile I could muster. "My gosh, what must you think of all this? This must be something to see what you've done." She was gushing now, despite my protestations that I was not personally responsible for this moment. "You and your movement are why we're here today," she said, "and I'm so proud of you and her." "I'm really, really proud of her, too," I offered, because that was genuinely on my spirit. We were now in a moment. This woman and me, our shared sentiments and heartache for Ford, had forged a connection. And then, as has happened so many times before with seemingly sympathetic white women, she dropped her bomb. "I just wish she remembered more, you know." I don't think I even allowed a moment for her to take her next breath before the attitude took over my body and I responded, "Excuse me?" I stared at her incredulously. "Oh, I believe her. Oh, please, no. I believe her." I'm just talking about for the sake of nailing that bastard, that's all. She offered in an attempt to clean it up. "I've never been through anything like that, but I imagine." That's where I cut her off. "Please don't imagine, miss," I implored. I reminded her that we, survivors like Christine Blasey Ford and me, but also her co-workers, neighbors, and friends, were there to tell her exactly how it was. I was trying not to allow a single tear to drop. I knew this lady did not mean any harm, but what she had said sent me to a place I don't often go. Looking directly into her eyes, I said, "I was 7 years old the first time I was raped." I gave it a beat to let it register. "I'm now 45 years old," I continued. "I've had a very full life with lots of highs and lows, and I'm flawed in many ways that I task myself at improving on a regular basis. But you know one of the flaws I have the hardest time with?" I did not wait for her response. "My memory," I told her. "It's because I've spent every single day of the last 38 years trying to forget. I do not want any memories if they have to include the memory of hot, stinky breath on my face and clammy hands roaming around where they don't belong. We're lucky she's able to recall anything at all. And if all we have to do is take in the words that took her 3 decades to pull from the pit of her stomach to the back of her throat and push them out of her mouth, then we should all feel privileged to do just that without judgment or complaint." The tears had come. So have this woman's. Her face was flushed and she stammered out an apology that I told her was not necessary if she would just please not repeat that critique of Ford's testimony. She agreed, and I found my way back into the hearing. If the past 5 years have taught us anything, let it be that the Me Too movement is not a spectator sport. Its fate is not decided in the court of law or the court of public opinion. The Me Too movement is what we make it, by how we commit to dismantling rape culture and undermining the violence it creates. It is how we take responsibility for creating a world without sexual violence and how we respond to the needs of the survivors who are already here. Like the woman in the bathroom who wished Christine Blasey Ford remembered more, so long as we in one breath say that we believe survivors and in another deny them the dignity they deserve, we will be focusing on answering the wrong questions and overlooking the right ones. Like, how have we created a world where 12 million outcries in 24 hours is not enough for us to fight like hell to address this? In her book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. The feminist scholar and author Imani Perry writes, awareness is not a virtue in and of itself, not without a moral imperative. 5 years ago, millions of people across the globe used the hashtag MeToo to find safety and solidarity. Survivors introduced a world of possibility to the fight to end sexual violence. Now we're moving beyond the hashtag to build a culture predicated on consent and harm reduction. This is our moral imperative. The millions of outcries cannot be unheard. To those who came forward, the words cannot be unsaid. Survivors did their part by waking the world up to this crisis. Please do not let another 68 seconds pass without doing yours. From the milestones, and that the previous article was slightly abbreviated, Sasheen Littlefeather, Essential Messenger, by Devery Jacobs. I was 11 years old the first time I watched the clip of Indigenous actor Sasheen Littlefeather at the 1973 Academy Awards. Littlefeather, who died October 2 at 75, took the stage on Marlon Brando's behalf, accepting his award in protest of Hollywood's depiction of Native Americans. That night, while calmly delivering her speech, Sasheen received boos and threats for her message. Sasheen's impact shaped my perspective on what it means to be an indigenous actor and activist. It also reaffirmed my responsibility to carry the voice of my community into the entertainment industry, despite its not always welcoming us. Being part of a new wave of indigenous creatives and being on a show like Reservation Dogs has felt like whiplash. Only recently have our stories been told in mainstream media. Every inch has been fought for. The groundwork laid by Sasheen Littlefeather continues to help make our successes possible. Devery Jacobs told this story to Sonia Mansour. Jacobs is an actor, filmmaker, and a member of the Kanian Kehaka Mohawk people. Died Loretta Lynn, country music trailblazer. Here's a black and white photo of her. A few decades ago, I'd say. She's dressed in a pretty costume, and she's holding a microphone in front of her face, and she's smiling, and she has long dark hair, and there are balloons flying behind her. In 1975, Loretta Lynn was one of the biggest stars in country music when she released a song that was quickly banned by many country radio stations. The song, The Pill, was an ode to birth control and sexual freedom that shocked many of the genre's more conservative listeners with lyrics like, "This old maternity dress I've got is going to the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few little fancy frills. Yeah, I'm making up for all those years since I've got the pill." It was this kind of sharp-witted and fearless storytelling that made Lynn, who died October 4 at the age of 90, a titan of country music and an inspiration to future generations of songwriters. While Lynn sang many homages to humble country living, she also breathed life and humor into taboo topics, whether it be cheating, female lust, or violent revenge. The pill stemmed from Lynn's personal experiences. "I had 4 kids before I was 18. If I had had the pill, I would have been popping it like popcorn," she told Time in 1975. Dozens of radio stations banned the song, and a preacher in West Liberty, Kentucky, devoted a sermon to denouncing it. Lynn said the song nearly got her kicked out of the Grand Ole Opry, but the controversy and hand-wringing only galvanized interest, and The Pill became the biggest crossover hit of Lynn's career. Since then, decades of country writers, from the Chicks to Miranda Lambert, have said that it inspired them to tell stories that were unflinchingly true to their lives. Potential backlash be damned. However, the groundbreaking song is still being forsaken by country gatekeepers. According to Luminate on October 4, The Pill was played just once by a country radio station in the U.S. in 2022. Andrew R. Chow wrote that article and again died. And this article was written by Kathy Eric Dowd. Angela Lansbury is the subject, effervescent star of stage and screen. Colored photo here of Lansbury. Looks like she's leaning out of a streamliner, a shiny metal steel rail car. Her hair is cut short and it's blonde, and she's neither smiling nor not smiling. She's wearing earrings and a coral-colored necklace over a coral-colored shirt underneath a white jacket. Angela Lansbury was perhaps best known for her 12-year stint as Jessica Fletcher on Murder, She Wrote, a role she landed at 58 when the CBS show debuted in 1984. But it was hardly a breakout performance. Lansbury, who died at 96 October 11, had been working steadily since a friend scooped her up from her job at a Hollywood department store and brought the teenager to the MGM lot to see about some movies they were making. Lansbury was introduced to the British acting world at birth. Her mother, Moina McGill, was a Northern Irish actor performing on London's West End when she met her politician husband, Edgar Lansbury. His death in World War II led the family to uproot for the U.S. Lansbury was 19 when she received an Oscar nomination for her cheeky Cockney maid in Gaslight opposite Ingrid Bergman. Next up was another Oscar-nominated performance in 1945's The Picture of Dorian Gray. But critical acclaim did not translate into a slew of starring roles, which many attributed to her unconventional beauty. While in her 20s and 30s, she was often cast as a middle-aged mother or dowdy professional, supporting bigger stars like Judy Garland and Elizabeth Taylor. A turning point came when she traveled to New York City to star in the musical Mame, portraying a roaring 20s bohemian. The show opened to rave reviews in 1966, earning her a Tony Award, and, she later said, the chance to be everything I never got to be in movies. On Murder, She Wrote, she fought to portray Fletcher as a strong, successful single woman. And she often invited friends from her MGM days to guest star. She continued working till the end. Her final appearance will be in this fall's Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery. As she quipped to Larry King in 2018, I'll probably pass away with one hand on my script. From the brief economy, I paid too much for a new car. You probably will too, by Alana Samuels. I needed a car, and there were no cars. Having just moved across the country from a city to the suburbs, I started my search for a new car with the self-assurance of most U.S. shoppers who've grown to expect that they can get everything they need with two-day delivery from Amazon or a quick drive to Walmart. Months after we began the hunt for a new compact SUV to combat the isolation of the suburbs, my husband and I paid $34,447 for a 2022 Subaru Forester base model with some added features. That's $3,002 over the manufacturer's suggested retail price, MSRP. The sticker price that for years buyers were counseled never to exceed. We also paid $800 in fees that the dealership sprang on us at the last minute, $199 for something called VIN, Vehicle Identification Number Etching, and a $599 conveyance fee, both of which I later learned I could have refused to pay. It might sound like I'm a terrible negotiator, but the truth is, supply chain snafus have turned the car market on its head. Low inventory of housing and cars resulting from the supply squeeze has taken away much of the bargaining power that buyers might have had, even at places like dealerships, where most things are negotiable. In July 2022, there were only 1.09 million new unsold cars on lots in the U.S., enough to meet demand for the next 37 days, according to research from Cox Automotive. That's a dramatic drop from July 2019, when there were 3.69 million new unsold units, or 88 days worth of supply. The reason so few cars are available may, at this point in the pandemic, sound familiar. After much of the world shut down to quarantine in early 2020, car manufacturers slashed their orders of semiconductors, or chips, and other parts, worried that there was going to be a worldwide recession. Chip makers started producing semiconductors for other more lucrative customers. So by the time consumers started trying to buy cars again in mid-2020, manufacturers could not get the parts they needed. Car dealerships appear to be benefiting from the shortages, although dealers are selling fewer cars, they're hiking the prices to compensate. The average gross profit for dealers for a new vehicle was $6,244 in the beginning of 2022, an 180% increase from 2019, according to the research firm Haig Partners. Some dealers are bringing in higher revenue by adding extra fees that buyers like me feel they cannot negotiate because there are so few cars available. The site, markups.org, which crowdsources consumer data, reports dealers in places like San Diego and parts of Florida have added as much as $16,000 to certain Toyota models this year. The imbalance in bargaining power between auto dealers and consumers has attracted attention from the Federal Trade Commission, which in June proposed a rule that, among other things, would require dealers to disclose the full price a buyer would pay for a vehicle if the customer inquires, excluding only taxes and government fees. The rule is opposed by the National Automobile Dealers Association, NADA, which argues it would add extra time and complexity to the car buying process. I would have preferred to just buy the car online, right from the manufacturer. But that's not allowed in the U.S., unless that car is electric. Each state has so-called franchise laws that require manufacturers to sell cars through locally franchised dealers. The system's decades old, but Jared Allen, a NADA spokesman, says the franchise system is without question the most consumer-friendly, automaker-friendly, market-friendly way to sell and service new vehicles in the U.S. Tesla has been fighting those franchise laws, waging legal battles in states across the country for permission to sell its cars online straight to drivers. Diverse groups, including the Koch brothers and the Sierra Club, have supported Tesla's efforts, arguing franchise laws interfere with competition and increase costs for buyers. While Tesla has prevailed in some states, its victories allow for only electric vehicle companies to sell directly to consumers. Dealers still have the lock on selling cars with internal combustion engines in the U.S., which means that although I'm not planning to buy another car for a long time, I already know one thing about it. I'm going to make sure it is electric. From the bulletin, with more Americans killed by guns and urgent need for answers, in 2021, Americans were killed by guns at the highest rate in 30 years, with a big increase following the pandemic. the homicide rate involving guns rose from 4.6 deaths per 100,000 Americans in 2019 to 6.63 per 100,000 2 years later, according to U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analyses. Suicides by firearm rose from 7.9 per 100,000 people in 2019 to 8.75. Experts say it's difficult to link the surge to any single explanation, but the increasing prevalence of guns may have been a major factor. The social upheaval of the past 2.5 years likely added to both violence and personal suffering, experts say. The COVID-19 pandemic led to widespread fear, uncertainty, and isolation, says Dr. Garen Wintemuta, director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at the University of California, Davis. Police violence and the public's reaction further unsettled many communities. Many Americans responded to that time of uncertainty by buying guns. 18% of U.S. households reported purchasing a firearm from March 2020 to March 2022, and about 5% of U.S. adults bought a gun for the first time, according to a University of Chicago survey. The CDC study's authors say their findings underscore the urgent need for prevention efforts, including outreach, hospital-based interventions, and reducing access to firearms among people at risk of harming themselves or someone else. Tara Law wrote that report. And a footnote here, if you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. For emergencies, call 911. Again, call or text 988. For emergencies, call 911. From the news ticker, abuse found in women's pro soccer. An independent investigation into the U.S. National Women's Soccer League released October 3 found emotional and sexual abuse were systemic throughout the sport. Misconduct by coaches was found to have affected professional players at multiple teams. Teen vaping epidemic far from over. An October 6 study from government researchers found 14% of high school students reported recent e-cigarette use this year. That figures down from the 20% of high schoolers who reported vaping in 2020, but an increase from 2021. Health experts say the study shows vaping rates remain high despite new regulation. Alex Jones ordered to pay nearly $1 billion. A Connecticut jury ordered Alex Jones and InfoWars to pay $965 million in damages to the family members of 8 Sandy Hook Elementary victims and an FBI agent on October 12 over Jones' false claims that the 2012 school shooting was a hoax. A jury in Texas previously awarded the family of another victim almost $50 million. More from the news ticker. Peace Prize goes to rights campaigners. Imprisoned Belarusian human rights advocate Aleš Bialyatsky, the banned Russian group Memorial, and Ukraine Center for Civil Liberties received the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize October 7. With the honor, the Nobel Committee underscored the importance of civil society in combating authoritarianism. Mass shooting at daycare in Thailand. Thailand's reeling from the country's deadliest mass shooting ever. After a former police officer opened fire on a daycare center October 6, killing at least 36 people, including 24 children. The atrocity is forcing Thais to examine the causes, narcotics, police corruption, and a proliferation of guns. NASA rocket diverted asteroid. A NASA spacecraft successfully knocked a small asteroid off course, altering its orbit. The space agency said the historic mission represented humanity's first planetary defense test, which could be used to protect Earth from future celestial threats. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's October 4 missile launch prompted emergency alerts in Japan. W.J. Hannigan writes, and this is going to be very highly abbreviated, not long after North Korea launched its fifth weapons test in 10 days, October 4, firing a ballistic missile high above northern Japan and prompting the government to warn citizens to take cover, a familiar routine began to unfold. Leaders from the U.S., South Korea, and Japan issued strongly worded statements condemning the dangerous and destabilizing provocation. The American and South Korean militaries conducted show-of-force exercises, including sending fighter jets to bomb a deserted island. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.